All right, this is Bram Kanstein, and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Tim Niemeyer. He's a Bitcoin advocate and author who began his Bitcoin journey in 2018. As a former U.S. Air Force avionics technician, he brings a unique technological insight to the Bitcoin space. And he's also enriched by his educational background, holding a degree in psychology and having experience as an elementary teacher. His recently published book, History Echoes Bitcoin, connects historical parallels to the core properties of Bitcoin. And we are going to talk about that and more in this episode. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you for having me, Bram.
Thanks for coming on. I absolutely loved your book. Thanks for sending it to me. We already talked off mic, but I think just the angle that you chose already makes this like a great read for people. And
you cut out this.
Like how did your book came about? Like why did you write it? How did that? What's the story behind it?
I actually never intended to write a book. I was just enjoying being a shit poster on Twitter like everybody else. And going through Bitcoin, I got to a point where I started to have those higher realizations. You know, you get the 21 million, you get the different, mm-hmm. the basic concepts. But then when you start putting all that together, you see things a different way. And once I had the idea for this book, it was just like, I kind of got to write it. I have to.
And so what do you want people to take away from it?
From this book, that there have been arcs throughout history, basically on the properties that Bitcoin represents. So permissionlessness, gaining consensus, decentralization, trust minimization, censorship resistance, open source collaboration, immutability, and scarcity. Each one of those things throughout history has shown to be beneficial to society in their own way. And we see history yearning for all of these. And they're all kind of coalescing in Bitcoin. And that's the overreaching takeaway I want people to start to see. That's my realization that I had just a year or so ago.
I love that you say that. Like it's yesterday I had a recording of a previous episode with Mitchell Askew, and it's so interesting that what you just said is very big, right? Like all these things from history, they are coming together in Bitcoin. And I think Bitcoiners often talk like that, but you know, and if you're standing on the sideline and you're looking at this, and then you could think like, oh, these guys are propping this up and they're talking like this. But
sure.
The constant realization, I almost want to say, is that like a lot of these things are actually true and happening. And so I feel that a lot of things that are said in the Bitcoin space are not really opinions, right? They are just kind of like discoveries from research that different people did in different dimensions and from different point of views, right? It's like, yeah, this is just my conclusion. It's not really...
Well,
an opinion almost.
And you almost have to hyper-focus on all these little things to, you know, the whole don't trust, verify. Mm-hmm. Kind of got to do it on your own and zoom. But then the realization comes when you're able to zoom out and not have such that like hyper-focus. And when you start to zoom out more, then you see how all these things come together. Forest for the trees concept.
Yeah. And so how do you think you have a really diverse background, which I just mentioned, right? Like in the Air Force, psychology, music, also you're mm-hmm. an elementary teacher. Like how did this combination of all these experiences help you like approach, but eventually also understand Bitcoin?
Well, let's add in farmer. My dad, okay. My father's a farmer, a retired farmer now.
Oh, cool.
And I started out a few years as a farmhand. And I was like, well, I could choose to do this, but I could also go choose to see the world. Chose the Air Force, got to live in Japan for a couple of years, get a perspective there. I could have stayed in for 20 years, got a retirement, or I could have gone out and got my college paid for. Thank you for paying your taxes, you know. Mm. Not you, but you know what I mean? So I did that. And then I got into psychology and I was like, you know, want to help the world. So I, instead of talking smack, doing something about it. So education made sense. I like kids. I like teaching. So I tried that. And I've been a musician kind of throughout, a guitarist, you know, very average at best. And then just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I had the opportunity to become the elementary music teacher. So all grade levels. So it's just one of those things of like, it's not so much getting bored with something, but it's like, ooh, a new opportunity. Let's try this. Hey, let's try that. And just try. It's the things that kept my interest. So that in doing that, that gave me the ability to see a lot of different perspectives. Like I said, my time in Japan, that was amazing. It was very eye-opening. We were talking before about like different cultures, and that was a culture I found so interesting, so fascinating, very respectful. And it was more of that shock of like, hey, what I've seen, like, for example, like level of disrespect in culture, you know, it's different from culture to culture, or level of respect, I guess you could say. And then being so respectful kind of shocked me to say, oh, there could be different ways of doing things. You know what I'm saying?
Isn't it in Japan also that it's also about honor, right? Like when, I hope this example is right, but this always stuck with me that, you know, if someone starts a restaurant, for example, right? Like the honor, or like they promise that they will do their best and create the best restaurant that they can create, right? And if then they have bad reviews and or people don't like it, then they just quit because that's their honor. Like they promised that they would do the best they could. And if people didn't like it, then they just quit, even though it might be a good business or something. Exactly. You know, that honor is very high. And so I don't know, like, I hope this is true because I love it as an example. But what's like the, now that you're back for a lot of years already, like what do you think about America now?
That's a very big question. What do I think about
maybe
America?
Not as a country, but like, how is it going? Now, also, let's combine it with, you know, just
contrast.
As like the whole Bitcoin point of view also, right? Like, I think Bitcoin, once you go into that, it opens your mind as well. And you find like other topics that you never looked at before, you know? So I think it gives you like a critical new viewpoint.
Absolutely. And going back to like, looking for new opportunities as you go along, Bitcoin kind of just fell in my lap and it gave me even more perspective. And in terms of like societally, like the one thing I see now that I just can't unsee is time preference and its effects on society. And I'm sure that's not just in America, you know what I mean? It's kind of everywhere, the high time preference mindset, which we believe is brought on through, you know, inflation or the effects of inflation, to see society so immediate needs, like poverty mindset, like I need this right now, as opposed to the I'm going to sell my chairs concept of living for Bitcoin. You know, there's such a stark contrast.
The people who listened to the previous episode will hear, again, I talked to Mitchell, he's 23. He showed me his office is a desk, a chair, and a computer, and his bedroom is a bed, one bed. And he has one chair in his living room. He's literally doing what you just said.
We both have plants in our background. We're living the high life, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
Not true Bitcoiners, you know, sell your plants.
Well, but it's interesting. It's also people are kind of like unknowingly forced into this short time preference lifestyle almost, right? And I don't think it's only with in like from a consumerism angle or that people want things when they want it, but it's also in discourse, right? Like it's like yes or no, good or bad, you know, like people don't really think about, I don't know, like two opposing arguments can be both be true, right? Or both be bad or not true.
That's so like critical thinking skills right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And so I find it difficult to see that people act really engaged or virtuous, but they are doing that on the basis of information that's just been shoved down their throat, basically. And they doesn't seem that they actually did that work sometimes.
You're considerably younger than I. Can you remember yourself pre Bitcoin? Because I know I can, and I
yes,
know
total
I lived,
oblivious.
And I lived a lot of that high time preference lifestyle.
Yes,
and you look
yes,
back and you're
yes.
just like, holy.
Well, I have 20 pairs of sneakers and now I don't buy sneakers anymore. No, but it's like that. It's I said this in a previous episode, and also one of the reasons why I focus on millennials. Like, I was 30 and working at a bank. I had a mortgage, and then a colleague was like, and I was already into Bitcoin. So that was like a weird thing. And a colleague said, did you know that money in the bank is not yours? And I said, well, sorry, what? What
yeah.
do you mean? And then he explained to me, and then I just felt like an idiot. I was like, I'm participating in something that I totally do not understand how it works, right? And it's, I think, less about fully understanding how it works, but going from zero understanding to a very important understanding that the money in the bank is not yours was just a really big shocker. And as you just asked me, like, the time before Bitcoin really clicked, you know, after a few times, yeah, I honestly think, like, where was I? Like, what was I thinking? Like, maybe I was lucky that I was in a safe Western country, that I didn't die along the way, right? Like, sometimes that's really how I feel. Like,
yeah.
Where was my mind? Like, where was I at? Was I even paying attention? Or was I just lucky? Yeah, like, am I lucky that I'm still alive or something? Like, maybe that's too big, but sometimes I really
I get
think about it like that.
Well, your listenership might not understand this concept, but I used to have, like, CDs. Did you have like,
yeah, of course. Dude,
I'm
36.
Okay. Cool. I'm going on 46 this month. So,
okay. Well,
but
I had CDs too.
I had so many like jazz and blues and funk and just all types of genres, just boxes and boxes of them. And I can't find them now. My mom might've thrown them away. I don't know.
Hmm.
Yeah, but it's like all the money and time. Now, it's music, and that filled my soul. Don't get me wrong, but just the idea of just buying, just
yeah.
consumerism. Consumerism
yeah.
is a big part of this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is a nice jump to
sure.
the things that you talk about in the book, because I've talked a lot about kind of like philosophical angle on Bitcoin in this podcast, but I like that you in your book, like, you touch upon ethical considerations for Bitcoin. Like, can you explain a bit about that?
Give me an example of what you're talking. When you say ethical, you're talking more
like that how a society could improve with the changes that
okay.
that Bitcoin can bring, and how, well, maybe it also kind of connects to what we just talked about, like the information asymmetry also, right?
Let's focus on like one aspect, one property of Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. I have a few I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
We could take permissionless.
Take permissionlessness.
Yeah. Yeah. So you draw in the book, there's a comparison between like the less permissioned South Korea and then North Korea.
Right.
Where you kind of like illustrate a permissionless system versus you have to have permission.
I put that in there, and that's one of the few, like, it wasn't like a historical event. It was just more of like a snapshot, a comparison. But what are the results of living a permissioned versus a permissionless lifestyle? And for those of you guys who know North Korea, it is going to be the more permissioned side, the more authoritarian side. Simple things like travel. Like, if you want to travel, you know, one terminal airport, and you can only go to two places. You can go to China or somewhere else.
Russia, maybe? I don't know.
Basically.
One of those.
South Korea, it's going to be more freedom laden. The education is better. The food is better. The ability to own your own house is better. The list goes on and on. You can have a passport and travel anywhere in the world. It just permissionlessness breeds freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like freedom to participate in the systems, right?
In any systems. And
yeah.
But that freedom in economic system frees up the ability in social systems and, you know, relationships and so many different factors of life. So the opposite of permission is permissionlessness is permissioned, and the opposite of freedom is what? So just in that concept right there, comparison of Korea, the ethical stance, you know, is that we should be aiming for permissionlessness. And how can we do that? Our current system, our current financial system, controls our ability to conduct ourselves freely because of all of the controls that we have currently on money, because the small few, the percentage of people with power, that they're able to control that system and gain more power. And they do that through a permission system.
Yeah. Well, it's even down to the level of if you call your bank and say, I want to get, I don't know, maybe 10K cash, they will ask you questions, right? So there's no freedom to get what you own, in a sense.
It's not your money in the bank, and there is no money in the bank. So like you said. Oh,
yeah. No, but is that, you know, if we look at the application of Bitcoin, the permissionlessness versus a permission system, right? Where, yes, you have to call the bank to get money from a certain amount, and they will ask you what you're going to use it for. And, well, if they deem that not good enough or not the good enough explanation, then perhaps you're not getting the money, right? Like that really, ethically, that goes against your individual freedom.
And, yeah, the banks are basically the, you know, financial watchdog, you know, part of the political system now. They can just, why would they ask you that in the first place? Because they want to know. And if they want to know, they get to choose whether that's okay or not.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
There's these videos of this guy, I think it's in Australia, and he just walks into the bank and he says, I want to draw, like, I don't know, 10 or 20,000 like Australian dollars from my account. And then they say, okay, what do you want to use it for? And he just gives them like crazy reasons, like the stupidest reasons ever. And then you see these people, they are just doing their job, obviously, but that's also part of the problem, in a sense. You know, if we think back about how oblivious were we, you know, like everyone needs a job, everyone needs a roof, everyone needs food, right? So those are like the first things that you focus on. But then when you are like at the outskirts of the system that is preventing other people from having their personal freedom, right? Like accessing the wealth or the money energy that they gathered that's in the bank. Like you don't, you know, these people also don't know what they are contributing to, of course. But it's just really interesting that he asks them then, like, why do you want to know? And then they say, yeah, that's just our protocol. And like, they don't, there's of course not really a discussion, but it's just interesting to see how people just operate without, I want to say, like, all the information or enough information or something. Like, it's
And that kind of goes back to that perspective we were talking earlier, and that how the scope of what you're looking at. Because you got to zoom in on certain parts to understand, you know, the inner workings, but you don't gain that until you zoom out. And to me, in a way, the zooming in is that high time preference, is a result of being a high time preference mindset.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if the people at the counter would zoom out and maybe ask like themselves, like, why am I asking this person what they want to do with their own money? Maybe that's already a little threat for them to explore further, to try and figure out like what am I actually.
If there's some cognitive dissonance going on there, you always wonder.
Yeah. Another aspect that you touch is decentralization. You mentioned the quote, centralization as a system is inconsistent with a non-violent structure of society. How does the principle of decentralization in Bitcoin contribute to a non-violent societal structure? Like, what's the difference here?
One thing I learned about a lot of in researching these books is there's a lot of crossover. So the permissionlessness is the permission system is able to succeed because it is centralized, right? Because there's that, not only is there a single point of failure, there's one entry point, you know. What did George Carlin say? It's like, it's a big club and you ain't in it.
You're not in it, yeah.
Yeah, so they have that.
That's a good bit.
Right? Oh, it's great rant. But decentralization, if you can actually implement it, you know, without fail, it stops the whole permissionlessness Now, if we have the optionality to choose. So if you and I wanted to do business and our bank said no, we could go say, you know, piss off, yeah, bank, and we can work together. That's decentralization in action on the small scale.
Yeah, they have a force over us because they are the only ones who control the access, right? And so when it's decentralized, it's kind of like the other way around. Like, you can only play if you follow the rules, as the enabler of what is happening with the money in that network, right? So it kind of turns it around.
Are you a sports guy? Is there a certain sport you like?
I want to say I golf, but I don't know if that helps your example.
No, that analogy is just doesn't make sense at all. Well, no. I mean, but like, so I'm a baseball guy. Mm-hmm. My son's 10 and he's loving baseball and growing up. So I'm coaching it and just loving it all over again. Imagine if we're playing baseball and my team against your team. And I am not only the player, not only the coach, the manager, but I'm also the umpire. Mm-hmm. And the rule maker and the scorekeeper, and I can change any one of those aspects to benefit myself. Now, you would hope somebody with upstanding, you know, moral structure would not, but that's just not the world we live in. You know, people are make decisions based on incentives. It's an incentive-based world. So if you have the ability in a game to make all those changes, you got to think this certain amount of the population is going to do that, right?
Yeah.
And decentralization keeps that from happening. It keeps that ability to make permissions, keeps that in check.
Yeah. Well, and you can try to mess around with it, but then you are just rejected by...
And they find out, yeah.
Yeah, by the network, right? Yeah, so it's also less obscurity in a sense. Right, because you have to follow the rules that the decentralized group agree to, and once you don't, then you cannot just participate anymore. All right, and to tie that back into what you mentioned about like the violence and non-violence, is basically, you know, is that about like a state having a monopoly on violence, or what do you mean?
Control, like how is it enforced? Obviously, Bitcoin is enforced through energy. Right? Proof of work. How is the fiat system enforced? Eventually, and this is not to get too like fire and brimstone, but eventually it comes down to force. If you don't pay your taxes, what are they going to do? You know, they'll come and get you. If you, you know, if you don't follow their rules, they will apply force. So to me, that's violence.
Yeah,
and a nonviolent society is basically a voluntary society where
you're also depending more on the others in the society.
Well,
right? Because and
you know, we said humans are make decisions based off incentives. So in a voluntary society, the incentive is to act well,
yes,
be good to one another,
yes,
because it reciprocates. In a permission society. In that centralized society, that violent society, we're all just kind of like, this is where actually I think politics comes into play. We're all just fighting for that control so I can change the rules to make you do what I say. So
Exactly. Yeah. So to not be dependent anymore on whoever is in charge, right?
Right.
And in a decentralized manner, you are all in charge. So you are dependent. Everyone is dependent on the other. It's not like one party is dependent on the other, right? I think... I want to say it right. I think like the perfect size for a barter society, like a localized society where this is optimized. I think it's 150 or 250 people.
I've heard that Dunbar number.
Yeah, I think it's 250.
250 sounds right.
So where everyone contributes their own thing, and they are all dependent on each other. There is no. Well, maybe there's an elder or something, but they are not the central ruler that controls what everyone needs to do, right? And there is only like one sentence for not doing your part. It's that you're kicked out of the group, basically. So the social cohesion and everyone doing their part, right? Like if you get the food in the jungle and you come back home and there and the dinner is made by someone else and someone else fixed the hole in your roof, you know, then you all contributed to, you know, that group in a sense.
You're cutting out.
But
there you are.
All the people know that once they don't do their little part, they can be exiled from the group, and that's just the only rule, right? So even if you try to mess around, other people will just, you know, hold you up against that rule.
That reminds me of one of the things I wrote about the Grand Council of Six Nations. So Northeast American Native Americans before the United States became a country, they were six different tribes. And they basically followed the simple idea that we're going to protect each other from foreign invaders, but we're also going to let each other make our own rules. We're all, you know, I don't tell you what to do. You don't tell me what to do. But hey, if we're getting attacked, let's back each other.
Yeah.
That's about as simple as you can get. In fact, the United States, Ben Franklin brought them in to say, this should be a model of our Constitution.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, the Dunbar number, by the way, is 150.
It is 150. Okay.
Yes. And it's the amount of also social relations that
yes.
you can have.
Right. Which supports the Grand Council,
yeah.
which supports localism, and in a way, Bitcoin allows for localism on a global scale, as opposed to the whole centralization, you know, model of like one global political, you know, order,
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
We're allowed to just interact freely. Crazy thought.
Yeah. Well, the next one I wanted to talk about is about trust minimization, right? So the trustlessness of Bitcoin, which, you know, the permissionlessness is about no one has to give you access to participate, right? Like anyone can participate. And the trustlessness is about you don't have to trust anyone, any person, which is a good thing, right? And you use, I thought it was a really cool example. You use like the Navajo code talkers in World War II, and that was like a method of trust minimization. And in Bitcoin, it's kind of used in a similar way. Why is this? Why do you see this as crucial to Bitcoin? And why did you choose this example?
Trying to remember back to that. So, like I was saying earlier, the arc of history, trying to move towards all of these different properties, simultaneously mm-hmm. speaking, trust is easily broken. And it has been repeatedly throughout history, right? So, I chose this example to kind of like illustrate, hey, it's early cryptography, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people outside of Bitcoin hear, you know, cryptography, they think crypto or cryptocurrency, and it's got a completely different definition. But cryptography in and of itself is just language, right? It's just math and code, right?
Yeah.
So the Navajo Indians basically were able to translate during the war into their own language, which was completely different than any other language at the time. So it was basically unbreakable.
Yeah, it was used as a way to send messages, right? Especially, I think in the Pacific activity of the U.S. right?
World War II, right?
World War II. Yeah, yeah.
So, just having that component. See, the thing about Bitcoin to me is each and of them in and of themselves are necessary. But the magic sauce, the sweet sauce, is where everything actually is put together and works together. Mm. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we discovered over the last, you know, altcoin cycle.
Yeah.
Or well, two,
that's
or
the
whatever.
Discovery that is Bitcoin, right?
That's the discovery. The
combination of all these aspects working together, basically.
I've been fighting back and forth, like, to really understand the whole, is it a discovery, is it an invention thing? And
yeah.
Because that's not very intuitive. And most people, you know, kind of just, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm leaning more and basically, and like on what you said, it is a discovery. Because like inventions, you can invent more things and put more bells and whistles on.
Yeah. It's about the combination of it's like the accidental discovery of penicillin or LSD or, you know, like these things were, right? Also accidental. This was on purpose, but it's a discovery. I think the engineering part in Bitcoin is about that Satoshi figured out how all these things fit together to actually provide, you know, what he wanted to create.
Imagine Satoshi's low time preference and his ability to zoom out to see how all those parts and pieces fit together. Because I agree that was his, like, there was, he added a few things, components that were very necessary that had yet to be implemented. Yeah. But just that ability to zoom out and say, I need every single one of these in order for the whole thing to work. That's the brilliance right there.
And also that these inventions were spread out over a pretty large time frame.
40, 50 years, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the trustlessness in Bitcoin, I find this a really interesting word, actually, right? Because it ties into what you just said, and I talked about this in the last episode as well, right? Like any proposed system that is potentially corruptible will be corrupted by someone who wants to do that, right? Even if you think, I would never do that, if I were in that position, like you know it's going to happen.
The incentives matter. I like to say, you know how everybody says Bitcoin fixes this? And I've said that many times myself. I tend to lean more now to Bitcoin incentivizes this. Because it's a system in place and people act differently based on different incentives, and the incentives are aligned in this system. So why wouldn't you want to adopt it?
Yeah, it gives you very a great rationale, I think, to also compare to current system and a possible future system, right? Like if you want to move towards Bitcoin, because what you just said about or what we talked about, like the teller at a bank who asks you a question about why are you using this money? She's like on the permission part, but you have to trust that policy came from somewhere that is helpful to a citizen like you, right? You have to trust that was created for a good cause. Basically.
And what is
and
that?
You don't even have the choice. I wanted to add, you don't have the choice to trust them. You just have to follow along, basically.
But that leads to if you think brain science and psychology, when you turn that skill off of the analytical skill of, is this good or is this bad or whatever, you're also not flexing that muscle, so to speak. Right. Mm-hmm. So it kind of dumbs us down over time if we're not thinking critically about all of these different decisions. So the trust model in that regard, where you don't even have the choice to think, so I'm not going to think about that. It leads to
you don't even see the problem.
Right. You don't. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's just the way it is. But that's also why I think that actually, when you think about the trustlessness of Bitcoin, so the trustlessness in Bitcoin basically is you don't have to trust any other person. The only two things I think you need to trust are the protocol. So if you understand what the protocol is, you know, the code that just is and just will work until forever, basically. That's the only thing you have to trust the code. And I think the second thing is you have to trust yourself that you're capable of, keeping your own wealth in your custody and all these things. I talk to a lot of people about Bitcoin, and this is one of the things that they find really hard is that the whole self-custody thing, right? Like if I have X amount in Bitcoin, oh, wow, I'm fully responsible. Yes, you're fully responsible. There's no one else coming to save me. No, there's no one else coming to save me, which implies there's also no forced trust, but you have to be able to trust in yourself that you will be diligent enough. Right?
Which forces you into a growth mindset, and going back to that, the reason you're feeling that fear is because that part of your brain hasn't been flexed in a while or in that way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you just didn't.
And you may not have the confidence in yourself to be like, I can do this. And after you do it for a while, it's like, that's not so bad, you know?
Well, I think for most people, it's probably more scary to trust themselves than to give away that that responsibility to being taken care of, basically.
Absolutely. Right?
So yeah. Next thing was censorship resistance. And when you talk about censorship resistance, you talk about the trial and execution of Socrates, which was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But as you discussed, right, like his ideas didn't really
canceled.
Say like,
yeah,
got canceled. Well, in the realest way possible, right?
Right.
And this was censorship by the state, is basically how you illustrate it. How does the censorship resistance of Bitcoin counteract a centralized control that, you know, we just talked about?
So yeah, this book is full of examples and non-examples, and to me this would be the non-example, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where that central authority is able to censor. The consensus was overridden by the few in the room. And all he was trying to do was just share his thoughts, you know?
Yeah. That we still think about today, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, the thoughts we all have and should, yeah, or should have, right? Mm. So that time was not censored. He was not resistant to censorship. So that's just kind of speaking to, hey, throughout history, you know, we kind of needed that. This guy who was really smart and helped a lot of people have a lot of new and better thoughts.
Yeah.
He was able to get censored. Why shouldn't we have a system that doesn't allow that? And the censorship resistance comes from the decentralization, right?
Hmm.
Because if, again, like,
but
if
once it's published, it's published.
It's published. Yeah. It doesn't matter my take on it, which gives a basis for reality as opposed to a spin or propaganda. Like if I can control the channels, I can tell you what to think and how to think. And enough times of hearing that, you're more likely going to kind of be sympathetic to it, at least, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But like you said, if we're able to broadcast that and everybody has this shared understanding of just the very simple truth, then it's hard to be like, well, this guy over here who's shouting, he's saying something different. Oh,
I feel. It's not.
Give me your I feel statement, please.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think this one I find like really illustrating and also correlating to like current times, right? Like it's the like freedom of expression and action is really countered with this like cancel culture, where I think, you know, this example of Socrates, people still talk about Socrates. They still talk about, you know, the thoughts that he shared or the mental models and stuff like that. And so he was actually right, you know, like,
yeah,
the fact, profoundly more right than whoever executed him, right? Do we ever talk? Yeah.
And the irony of that is that despite all their best intentions, his thoughts still live on, and he lives on. So over time, the truth won out. And
yeah, well, you know, we also still talk about the Greeks, right? But
yeah,
I find cancellation like one of the weakest, it's the weakest form of any, I want to say dialogue, but it's not even a dialogue, but it's about like, where did we take this exit where we can't just discuss ideas, right? Like if you operate from kind of like first principle or like a mental model of I know that I don't know everything, then whatever you think could also be interesting for me to learn about, right? I don't have to agree and you don't have to agree with me, but maybe both of our ideas are good or bad, right? Like why did we take that exit? And the Bitcoiner answer would probably be like fiat money, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do feel that the money is kind of like also one of the base layers of interaction between people, right? We are exchanging value, and exchanging ideas is also exchanging value. So in some way, I don't want to say I know the exact cause, but I feel like that is definitely part of it. Just the ability to exchange information and value with each other is corrupted, I'd say. And this is like one of the examples. of that. It's not facts, it's more feelings, right? And the feelings are legitimized, and then this, someone is canceled. Well, in Socrates' time, he was actually killed.
Facts are like a raft on a raging ocean where, you know, you have the truth that's just sitting there like a battleship. You know, it's not going to be deterred.
Mm. Well, I think it's also interesting that when you dive into Bitcoin, it's like I said in the beginning, and a lot of things people in Bitcoin say, they feel like opinions, but they're just kind of like objective realizations or observations, right? Like there's opinions obviously in this space, but
sure.
Sometimes I hear myself say things about Bitcoin where I think like, oh, that sounds so ridiculous. Sounds such like a hype type statement, right? Or a shill for Bitcoin. But that is actually then not the case. It's just my own realization of something that I deeply studied.
And you mentioned first principles. And one of the guys that really bore that into my head was Jeff Booth, one of your previous guests, which that was a great episode. I just love that episode. But speaking from first principles, yeah, it's like, okay, you can say you don't like that, but you can't disagree with it.
Doesn't change the fact.
And if you can't disagree with it, then what is one of your only other tools is to cancel it, you know, to try and censor it. Mm-hmm. It's like, and like you said, that's weak. That's beta. That's, you know, we can do better than canceling each other's thoughts. It's like, come at me with reason and logic.
But why do we accept, or why is it accepted? Why is cancellation accepted currently? What do you think about that?
Again, an incentive of the fiat system, because the high time preference mindset is like, oh, I'm feeling discomfort from this current situation of cognitive dissonance. So instead of like putting in the proof of work to argue it or think it through or change my mind, it's easier to just turn it off or swipe, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to do the work to understand why this objective truth messes me up so much inside.
Right.
Yeah, funny. I feel that people who really like dove into Bitcoin, they understand this proof of work thing that you have to... I also have the same feeling as sometimes people have opinions and then I think like, but how substantiated is this opinion? Like, did you do enough work to form this opinion, right? And I really try to operate from a point where I want to know enough, and that's my own quality like bar, right? Like how much work I do, but I want to know enough before I have an opinion, because it's just,
oh gosh,
it's also a disingenuous conversation, right? If I have an opinion about something that you, I don't know, studied for 10 years, it's like I'm not even respecting your time or intelligence or whatever when I'm not able to just...
I couldn't tell you who the best golfer is, so I'm not even going to try.
I have no clue either.
I thought you're a golfer.
Yeah. No, I'm a golfer. I don't follow it. But I find, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
This is just... I could talk about this for a long time, but it's... interesting. Last one I wanted to touch upon from the book was the scarcity aspect. Like, you reflect on how video games with unlimited lives influenced your behavior due to like a lack of scarcity, right? Like, I don't know, I played Grand Theft Auto also when I was younger. Like, I can just do this crazy thing, or I could just die there and I spawn again, right? So I thought it was like a nice example, but you draw a parallel to the real world concept of scarcity. Like, can you explain this analogy that you used here?
To me, that's also an incentive kind of thing, right? It's an incentive of the system. Like, I'm going to run balls to the wall into, you know, Super Mario. I'm going to just run and jump. I'm going to get that eventually, but, you know, I'm going to die in the process and it doesn't matter because I'm going to keep going. So
yeah,
as if it was a different... Now, video game probably wouldn't be played if it only had one life, right? If you had one life and you're done, there nobody would play the video game. But scarcity changes how you act. So Jeff Booth quote,
makes you more cautious, or you have to think, right?
Abundance in resources leads to scarcity elsewhere, scarcity in resource, you know, that concept right there, it is huge. So
well, abundance takes away boundaries, I'd say, right? And boundaries are very important for making a plan, being creative, analyzing, you know, possible strategies, etc. So if you can do anything you want, it's kind of like, I think this is one of kind of like the millennial tenets, right? Like we could always do anything. So we get like, it's the paradox of choice also, in a sense, right?
That analysis that, paralysis.
Yeah. I can do anything. What should I do? Oh, I don't know. Or I try everything and I have no direction, right? I think it has to do with that scarcity forces you to think within the frame of the scarcity that is given to you, whether that's 21 million Bitcoin or a certain amount of time or whatever.
And the scarcity also it is about respect and respecting time and effort, you know? So when we print millions and millions, we create inflation and each unit in the system is worth less and less. And if you're working for those units and the current system is set up to devalue that, it's basically devaluing your time and effort. And that's disrespectful. Mm-hmm. I take offense to that. I mean, well, and that's one of the main reasons I love Bitcoin is because it's respecting my time and effort.
Yeah. I saw a tweet. The US Defense Department has failed its financial audit for the sixth consecutive year. This is a prime example.
Surprise.
Right?
Like, surprise face.
If you didn't have to do it after 3 years, then, well, probably also not after 4 and 5 and 6. So there are, I think this is a prime example of no boundaries.
It's that kind of reminds me of the phrase, like, if you're talking to a banker, if I owe the bank $1,000, that's my problem. If I owe the bank $1 million, it's their problem. You know, once it gets so big, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think it is hard for people to find a thread, let alone more threads to start pulling from, right? To learn. And also when I look back at my own journey, I find it hard to really say like, oh, that's when it clicked, or that's when I really saw something that I couldn't unseen before. Like, how's that for you? Like, are there specific things that triggered you, or was it like a slow journey?
I started to buy in and study in the middle of 2018, which was after the last big peak of 2017. It came down and kind of flattened out. And like, I bought the week before it went from like 6,000 down to 3,000. So I learned real quick. I'm like, what the hell, man? But I kept learning it because it was interesting and I like to geek out on stuff and it was, you know, a new opportunity. So, and I've always been about like libertarian leaning decentralization anyway. So that kind of clicked there, but the real eye opening was 2020 and that crash and everything that ensued, regardless of politics or anything else. It was just like, holy shit, all of these properties that we've been discussing, or most of these properties, just got flipped on their head, and they were already on that trajectory, you know, the scarcity, money printing. Well, look at all the money we spent there. The centralization. Well, now we're taking control of all aspects of your life, whether it was a good cause or not. I don't even, that's irrelevant to this discussion. The ability to gain consensus. We can't even agree with sciences, you know, and it's all based on, it's all based on that truth feeling aspect we had before. There was a lot of fear. We didn't have permissions, you know, we couldn't see information being changed through laws, so it wasn't open source. You know, like all of these concepts in Bitcoin were being challenged, and Bitcoin was resilient through the whole thing. And not only resilient, it was anti-fragile. You know, it got stronger.
Yeah.
And that gave me hope. That gave me, you know, peace of mind. Where everybody else is flipping out, I kind of had something to hold on to be like, this all makes sense. This is all all reason.
This thing doesn't change. Logic. It doesn't care.
It's staying strong through the storm.
I think that's actually a very strong realization that when name anything else that doesn't care. Well, nature maybe.
Honey badgers, nature, maybe. Nature, I don't know.
Yeah, honey badgers too. But no, like nature doesn't care about what we do. Like nature will always survive in a sense, even when we. When we die out, nature will always survive. And I think when you have that insight into Bitcoin, it's interesting also when like a price really goes down and you think like, oh, what happened? Did it like crash, or like did Bitcoin, the technology crash, or did something change, or a hack or whatever? Like, no, nothing changed. It's all purely the human psychology.
The asymmetry of information and all that. Yeah,
exactly. But it's the thing, the basics, the fundamentals have not changed. It's still the same. You can read about what has actually changed if there's something changed to the core, right? But mostly it's just chugging along. It's just there. You know, I think that gives me personally a lot of rest. I'm a pretty risk averse person. That's actually why I Bitcoin. Like, I don't have to worry about all this external influence and all these people trying to mess with whatever other system I could be involved in. And for me, it's just like, I know this, it'll just keep doing its thing. That actually gives me a lot of peace.
I love that.
So we talked about a few aspects. You mentioned others before. Like, which of the aspects of Bitcoin do you think has like the biggest potential impact, or is it more like what you mentioned before,
yeah,
like that combination that, you know, they strengthen each other?
It's the confluence. It's the secrets. The mix. You know, it's all of them working in tandem in concert is what makes it the discovery that it is.
Yeah. So what's the biggest misconception you think people have about Bitcoin, or what's like the biggest one that you run into?
I don't even think it's misconception. I think it's lack of conception. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of FUD out there for sure, but it's like, so I started, just cause I like to geek out about Bitcoin, I started making like YouTube shorts and stuff, mm-hmm, about Bitcoin education. And I was sitting in my son's jiu-jitsu lesson, and I just finished one, and I leaned over to somebody who I've known, you know, since high school. And I was like, told her what's going on. I was like, hey, can you take a look at this? And it was on scarcity. And I was like, you know, what's your takeaway from it? And she said, I didn't know there was a limited supply. Okay. So Bitcoiners get so deep down the rabbit hole that we can't even see out and see how people are walking around, you know, without it, even like the slightest understanding.
Very interesting.
So I could imagine I could have that conversation with her on every other one of these properties, right? And yeah, I'd have to do them separately just to even like crack the surface, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so what are you doing with the YouTube shorts? Trying to yeah, make it simpler then? Or like,
yeah,
say there's only 21 million? Like, what's your goal there?
So here's a fun one. A study from like at least 10 years ago analyzed the speech pattern or the difficulty of like text complexity in presidential speeches throughout the decades. And what they noticed was it went from a collegiate level decades ago. You want to guess what the reading level is now for?
I don't know, seventh grade or something.
Fifth grade. And that was that was in 2014. So I hate to see what it is now. So,
well, now it's like,
it's yelling and screaming and beating their chest, right?
Yeah.
So my thing is, like, I'm an elementary teacher. I've been doing that for almost 20 years. It's like, you got to find the frequency at which they can receive, mm-hmm, right? So I'm going to be making shorts. They're going to be more for the no coiner, I guess you could say. And I'm going to make it not to disrespect anybody's intelligence, but I'm just going to make it bite-sized chunks, easier to understand. So I think that's like, you know, you get into conversations, I want to talk about the consensus algorithm, and they're like, what? I don't know what either of those words mean. So I'm kind of trying to take my education background and my Bitcoin knowledge and put it toward there. That's the orange pill I'm going for.
Yeah, great angle. Like, I think there's still so much to do, right? So there's so many opportunities when also for people who listen to this, like, if you're enthusiastic about Bitcoin, you can, yeah, I started a podcast, you are going to do YouTube shorts, like, you can do anything to contribute and help people, right? And as you mentioned, like, you cannot expect that everyone that you potentially talk to knows the basics, like the fixed supply, right? And there's just so much to win. So yeah, I love that. Did you actually start with it yet?
Yeah.
Or are you going to?
I'm going with Zoom out. So you can, it's Zoomout 21 on Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, awesome. Not Instagram, but whatever.
I'll link to all of them in the, yeah, in the show yeah, yeah. notes. So people can check it out.
Yeah. And also I'd say for your listeners, go to local meetups. I co-host Lincoln Land Bitcoin Meetup in Springfield, Illinois, which is in the middle of a cornfield. So I doubt your listeners are going to show up there, but yeah, if there are no local meetups, start your local meetup, you know.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity right there.
100% agree. So what's like a personal story that highlights the impact of Bitcoin on your life? Is that,
yeah.
Well, is the meetup one of those things? Or
oh yeah, what? No, absolutely. I'm more of an introvert, historically speaking, or I guess pre-Bitcoin. So putting myself out there and making connections that way and growing my personal local Bitcoin Dunbar number, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That right there has been huge. It's done a lot. I know it sounds silly to people who might not understand have been down the rabbit hole, but Bitcoin has changed my perspective on health. I've become so much more healthy, and I feel so much better. I'm so much more productive, respecting my own time, having a lower time preference. There's so many factors that lead into that.
Is that about being more aware or?
It's the proof of work. You know, you might see a good tip, health tip, more sleep or better nutrition or exercise or whatever, but like implementing those things and making them like default, you know, and making them all work together is kind of where that's all kind of come together in the last year or two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I talked about that in the last episode as well. It's really about walking the talk, basically.
It really is. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's I think big part of the Bitcoin ethos. So, I want to move on to my last question and I ask everyone the same thing. What's a core belief that you will never let go?
Good ideas don't require force. If we have to persuade, that's one thing. If we, you know, educate, that's obviously another thing. But if we have to force somebody to do something, even if we think it's good, that doesn't mean that everybody else thinks it's good from their perspective. And that force is just leads down a bad path. It leads to more force and it leads to inverse force, you know, the reaction to force. So if we can build a voluntary society, it's unforced and that leads to prosperity, wealth. You know, good times for all, you know.
Awesome, man. I love it. Thanks so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And where can people follow you online? I will link to your YouTube and the book.
Thank you. My personal is Tim_Niemeyer_ History Echoes Bitcoin is on Amazon. It's at HISTECHOHIBTC, HIST, Echoes Bitcoin. And then the other stuff on YouTube and Twitter at Zoomout21.
Awesome, man. I hope people will check it out.
And Lincoln Land Bitcoin.
Yeah, so if you're around.
If you're in the middle of a cornfield in the middle of America, yeah. Lincoln Land BTC.
Awesome. Well, thanks again and keep in touch.
Thank you.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm BramK, that's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.